Committee for Tuesday, February 5th, 2008. This is our organizational meeting, and the first item on the agenda is the adoption of committee rules. We have members to the standard set of committee rules sitting on the table in front of you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Whitner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the committee accept the House Committee on Judiciary Special Rules for the 2008 special session.
Representative Wisnett has moved adoption of the House Committee on Judiciary Rules as presented to you in standard form on the table in front of you. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
I will move to adopt these committee rules. However, I must put on the record my objection to rule number 13, which was the subject of floor debate yesterday in regard to minority reports. I still have serious objection and concern about that particular provision, but understood that they are the House rules. I will move to vote in the affirmative.
So noted. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
I will also be voting no.
Actually, Representative Flores said she would be voting yes.
In the affirmative,
under the rules, but
I'll
be
accepting.
Voting no.
We'll
be voting no, okay. Stand at ease for a moment. We have a motion before us for adoption of the committee rules, and we're in discussion. Any further discussion of the motion to adopt the standard form committee rules? If there's no further discussion, then we'll take a roll call vote.
Aye.
No.
With the exception noted, aye.
Representative
Tom? Aye.
Representative
Krieger?
Excused.
Aye.
Vice
Chair Barker? Aye. Vice Chair Whitman? No. Chair McPherson? Aye. Motion carries. The rules are adopted. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3633. Councilor Taylor, give us an orientation to the bill.
Chair, members of the committee, you may remember the last session the legislature referred under H.R. 49 and 50, two amendments to the victims' rights provisions of the Oregon Constitution. What you have before you is the implementation legislation. Attorney General is here with Pete Shepard from his office, and they've been working for about the last 5 or 6 months with various groups. In fact, I was at a meeting last night on not only the bill, but on some amendments to the bill, too, which we'll be seeing later. They're here to testify.
Very good. So I'd like to invite Attorney General Hardy Myers and his Deputy Pete Shepard forward to make a presentation on the bill. And understand that these gentlemen have a fairly extensive presentation to offer up. So I would, and I think in terms of questions, we had talked about, with your indulgence, gentlemen, I think we would, if people have questions as you go along, it might be best for them to feel free to interject those at whatever point they're raise them rather than waiting to the end of a fairly extensive presentation. Of course. Very good.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Deputy Attorney General Pete Shepard, and we appreciate the opportunity to open your consideration of House Bill 3633. Before we turn to the measure, I'd like to take just a moment to put the measure in historical context for you. As the committee administrator was just noting, the stage setter for this legislation was the regular session's decision to approve House Joint Resolutions 49 and 50, which proposed certain changes to the sections of the Bill of Rights that grant crime victims certain constitutional rights. And copies of the enrolled House Joint Resolutions are among the materials that have been distributed to you. And I want to take just a moment to focus on the change, the major changes those resolutions would make, so as to, again, provide the context for this legislation. Present provisions of the Oregon Constitution that deal with crime victims' rights provide that nothing in this section, that is the section of the Constitution granting the rights, may be used to invalidate an accusatory instrument, ruling of a court, conviction or adjudication, or otherwise suspend or terminate any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceedings at any point. That restriction appears in both sections 42 and 43 of the Bill of Rights. The effect of those restrictions, particularly the sections, the provisions dealing with prohibiting any overturning of a ruling of a court or any suspending of a criminal or delinquency proceeding, the effect of those restrictions is to make it, as a practical matter, impossible for victims to effectively assert and claim a violation of their rights. So the key change that these two joint resolutions invite the people of Oregon to make is to, first of all, to remove those provisions dealing with ruling of a court or the suspension of a proceeding, and then to instead provide that except as otherwise provided in, and then there's a reference to a later subsection in the joint each of the joint resolutions, except as otherwise provided in those subsections, nothing in this section may be used to invalidate a ruling of a court or to suspend any criminal or juvenile delinquency proceeding. So that's the key change. That is the gateway amendment to creating a system by which victims can effectively assert and claim violations of their constitutional rights in the criminal justice process. The joint resolutions, however, are not themselves self-executing in any detailed way. They do not tell the criminal justice process how it is to implement that policy change that I just was describing if the people approve it in either or both of the joint resolutions. And so, as I was mentioning to the joint committees, interim committees, when I appeared before you in November to advocate for this kind of a measure being a February session agenda item, the absence of that detail for the criminal justice process, combined with the vote on the measures in May, as opposed to November, creates the possibility that we could have a period of some 6 to 8 or 9 months going into the next regular session during which the criminal justice process would have absolutely no guidance as to how it is to carry out that policy change embodied in the two joint resolutions. So all of the participants in the system, district attorneys, judges, crime victims and their counsel, criminal accused and their counsel, all of these key participants in that process would be left to their own devices as to figuring out what to do and when to do it and how to do it in relation to the implementation of the joint resolutions. Both joint resolutions pretty expressly contemplate that the Legislative Assembly will be providing detailed guidance for the implementation of the measures. And I think it is to the credit of the Assembly that it has chosen to act on that need in February, as opposed to waiting until the next regular session, so as to forestall the possibility of a criminal justice process without any guidance as to how to carry out the approval of either or both of the joint resolutions. The measure before you, House Bill 3633, is the product of a multidisciplinary working group that I convened early in December after the legislature's approval of this item as a February agenda matter. And the composition of that work group has been distributed to you, its roster. It has been meeting since very early December. It had what I think might be its culminating meeting yesterday to review the introduced measure and to develop a set of recommended, what will I think be -1 amendments that are now in process. And we will be referring as we go along to some of those amendments, which are not yet ready for the committee's consideration. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like now to begin a review of the measure itself. I'm going to discuss Section 1, which deals with Attorney General rulemaking authority, and then Pete will pick up for that point to walk through the balance of the measure, and as indicated, we'd be very pleased to have you take your questions as we go along. Section 1 of the bill, which, as you see, is a provision which is proposed to be effective regardless of the outcome of the vote on the two joint resolutions. It is a freestanding authorization. This section arises from the fact that the Oregon Department of Justice for the last 3 years has been the recipient of a federal grant to enhance compliance with crime victims' rights. And that project has undertaken a variety of efforts, education among them, and one of the, I would say, culminating goals of the project is to create a non-judicial process by which complaints of violations of crime victims' rights can be, to which it can be submitted, and those complaints evaluated, and recommendations for change issue from that process. In considering some months ago the creation of such a process, the project, in consultation with me, concluded that rulemaking by the Attorney General would be an appropriate way to actually create the process, bring it into being. But there was also uncertainty about whether the Office of the Attorney General currently would have such rulemaking authority. So it's really to dispel any issue about that authority that Section 1 has been included in this overall Victims' Rights Compliance Bill. And it would authorize rulemaking to create this alternative process independent of the process that's described in this measure, later in this measure, for the receipt of complaints, their assessment, and the issuance of recommendations for change. And then this also authorizes the Attorney General, this section, to promulgate model rules, procedures, or policies effectuating rights granted victims. And while those model rules are not going to be enforceable at law, according to this provision as now standing, the Attorney General is authorized to condition the provision of crime victim assistance funds or support by the Oregon Department of Justice on compliance with such model rules, procedures, or policies. There will be in the Dash 1 amendments two or three proposed amendments to this section, and those will be before the committee when the Dash 1s are ready for distribution and review by you. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like now to ask the Deputy if he would.
And if I could just break in, Attorney General Myers, just to make sure I'm understanding clearly, the model rules then would be adopted by local law enforcement agencies or local prosecutorial offices. Who model rules contemplate that somebody else is then acting on the model rules. So help me understand who's going to act on those.
Yes, Chair McPherson, I'm quite sure they could be model rules that could be appropriate for adoption by the district attorney's office, by a law enforcement agency, by a victim's advocacy organization. I think there are several possibilities for guidance as to procedures that would be intended to ensure compliance with victims' rights in terms of these different participants in the total process.
And then as a follow-up to that, the leverage that is created by the conditioning funds for support, when I start thinking about what kind of support then the Department of Justice provides to those offices, I think of District Attorney's Assistance Program for assisting with local prosecutions. Maybe there are others. There are other forms of assistance that the department provides that would be then conditioned upon adoption of the model rules. Is that what you have in mind?
Sure, McPherson. Well, specifically, yes. There are two primary flows of assistance that come from the Department of Justice. One flows funds out to the victim assistance programs of the district attorney's offices in each of the 36 counties, And then there are a variety of grants that flow out of the department to victim advocacy organizations, victim service organizations. Those are the two primary flows that are crime victim assistance funds or support.
So to clarify, then it's not other forms of assistance. It is crime victims assistance that would be could be conditioned upon failure to adopt the model rules. Then could interrupt the flow of crime victims assistance that flows to that jurisdiction.
Chairman Pearson, that is correct.
Gotcha. And any further questions on Section 1? Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Before I pick up where the Attorney General left off, that is with Section 2 of the draft, let me mention three preliminary matters. First, I don't want the occasion to pass without giving our thanks to Josh Nasby, one of your legislative council drafters who has, I won't say suffered through our working group meetings, but has endured them at any rate. And he's been a very great help to us, and we appreciate his assistance. And I know he's got a lot of other things on his plate, but it's been very, very helpful to have his help in the working group. Second, I want to take you back to the actual text of the Oregon Constitution, just by way of a quick reminder and refresher about what rights we're dealing with here, just so that everybody starts with a common understanding of what those are. And then finally, before I turn to Section 3, just briefly mention some features of H.R. 49 and 50 that will continue to be the law, notwithstanding the people's approval, if that is to be forthcoming in the election, because those bear on the way we've drafted the proposal. So to the specific rights, Article 1, Section 42, which would be amended by H.R. 49, contains a number of different rights that are granted to victims in all prosecutions for crime and in juvenile court proceedings. And the fact that those rights apply in both adult court criminal prosecutions and in juvenile court prosecutions is one of the complicators in crafting the proposal that you have before you today in terms of the implementing legislation. So recall that as you look at the implementing legislation, that under the Constitution, the rights attach in both of those forums. Those rights include the right to be present at what the Constitution leaves as undefined, but it describes as critical stages of those proceedings. The right to be heard at pretrial release and at sentencing hearings and at the juvenile court equivalent of a sentencing hearing, a juvenile disposition proceeding. To obtain information, including transcripts of the proceedings in which the victim might have an interest. To refuse an interview that the defendant in a case may be seeking to impose upon the victim. To receive prompt restitution. In cases involving violent felonies, the right to be consulted by the prosecutor before a plea negotiation is concluded. And finally, in Section 42 of Article 1, the right to be informed of the foregoing rights, so the right to know that you have those rights. Section 43, which would be amended by H.J.R. 50 if the people were to approve H.J.R. 50, deals with a narrower class of rights, but nonetheless significant. And here, they're in particular, the Section 43 secures for victims the right to be reasonably protected from the criminal defendant or convicted criminal throughout the criminal justice process. And later in the provision, there's language that extends that to juvenile delinquency proceedings. And then also in Section 43, significantly for victims and for the public, is the right to have the trial court make release decisions, quote, based on the principle of reasonable protection of the victim and the public, as well as the likelihood defendant will appear for trial. So when I describe, as I will in a minute, the mechanism we've tried to create in the bill for enforcing those rights, those are the kinds of rights that we're talking about. That's what we're referring back to when we say we want to empower victims to bring these claims to a court and have redress for them from the court. Before I turn into Section 3, the last kind of preliminary matter is just to note several features of H.R. 49 and 50 that will not change the existing law. So, for example, even if H.R. 49 and 50 are approved, still the remedies that those amendments will authorize in the future cannot include a remedy that would violate a criminal defendant's suspension of a proceeding that would violate a criminal defendant's constitutional rights under the Oregon or United States Constitution. For example, the Constitution will continue to forbid, even if the people amend it, as proposed in the two joint resolutions, any suspension that would deprive a defendant of the right to a speedy trial, for example. So the Constitution will continue to have some limitations on the remedies available to victims. And similarly, the Constitution will continue to limit the remedies to prohibit some of the kind of common things that you might think of as remedies for violations of rights, including compensation, damages. In the context of the criminal case, the Constitution will continue to bar invalidation of the accusatory instrument itself, so it won't be a basis to invalidate an indictment, for example. And it won't, the Constitution still will not permit, even if it is amended by the people, the termination of a criminal prosecution, as opposed to its suspension to take account of the victim's rights, even if the Constitution is amended. And finally, by way of limitations, the amendments themselves will include an additional potential limitation on victims' rights. And that is that in cases involving organized crime or cases involving children who are victims, minors who are victims, the prosecuting attorney, if the Constitution is amended, will be able, won't be required to, but will be able to interpose an affidavit with the court that explains why, in that particular case, the victim should not be allowed to enforce their rights. And this came about, you may recall from your considerations of H.R. 49 and 50, because prosecutors were concerned that in those kinds of cases, there might be a greater danger than in other kinds of cases that victims might be enlisted to aid the defendant in ways that were inimical to the public interest in that particular kind of or class of case. So, bearing in mind those limitations, then, House Bill 3633 is designed to be the victim's remedy by due course of law, presuming that the people approve the joint resolutions. And let me start there by way of explanation of the bill. A very great amount of the technical complexity and bulk of the bill arises from the fact that we're dealing with two House joint resolutions. In theory, the people could approve one and disapprove of the other, in any combination of those. They could approve 49 and disapprove 50, or approve 50 and disapprove 49. One might make a political judgment that that's unlikely to be the result, but nonetheless, we have to account for that in the drafting. And so much of the bulk and technical complexity of this bill arises just from the fact we have to deal technically with the possibility that one will pass and not the other. So let's turn then to just a real quick run through in the form of this flow chart, still without reference to particular subsections of the bill. You should have it's a two-page flow chart. I don't propose to go through all the details on the flow chart, but I just want to walk you through the steps so that as we get immersed in the details of each of the sections in the bill, you'll have something to refer back to place it in context. The process would be initiated on the flow chart. It's described as the victim informs the court within 7 days of the alleged violation and proposes a remedy. That's referred to in the bill as filing a claim with the court. And we have provided in the bill that the Supreme Court will produce a form that the victim can use to do that, so that the victim will have ready access to a form that even a lay victim without the assistance of an attorney could work their way through and get redress and invoke the authority of the court. On the basis of the victim's submission to the court, the trial court would issue what's called a show cause order. And basically, this is just an order that says to people who ultimately receive it, if you object to what the victim has alleged and what the victim would like to have me do as the trial court to remedy the alleged violation, then you need to appear in the way that's described in this order and register your objections with the court. That's what a show cause order is. The folks who might have objections to that show cause order then are required to file objections to it. And if they do, then a hearing would be scheduled, and the court would consider the objections at that hearing. The court then would issue an order based on the findings at the hearing, or if there were no objections, then the court would enter an order based on the fact that nobody had objected and grant the relief or deny it if it weren't a kind of relief that the Constitution permits. And then, in order to fully effectuate the victim's rights and also to recognize that the order that the victim might obtain might impinge in a way that the defendant found objectionable or potentially the prosecuting attorney or even some other third party who might otherwise be bound by the order, we clearly had to provide for some kind of appellate remedy. And so on the second page of the draft, you can see some of the steps in the appellate process that are laid out. And this is an appellate lawyer's dream to design a whole new appellate process, and we've had hours of discussion of the exact way in which best to articulate these procedures, but we've had the benefit of some very able lawyers to assist in designing the system. Suffice to say, for this overview, we've tried to design a system that is very, very rapid, because it's in the interest of everybody involved to quickly iron out this dispute, get it resolved so that the matter in the trial court can proceed in an orderly way and quickly. And so we have provided, for example, for direct appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. Ordinarily, as you know, appeals are processed through our intermediate court, the Court of Appeals. And in this instance, the Judicial Department suggested that this would be a class of matters that, if properly designed, would be appropriate for the Supreme Court to take directly on appeal. And so that's what the draft is that you have before you. And we have provided that the Supreme Court will issue its order within 21 days. On the last printed page of your, second page of your flow sheet, flow chart, there are actually two categories of cases on appeal, and we've separated them out according to the really the severity of the allegation of the underlying criminal matter. So on the one hand, we have appeals involving felonies and Class A person misdemeanors, and on the other hand, a class of all other criminal proceedings, and including probation violation and revocation matters. As to the first class, the felonies and Class A person misdemeanors, the Supreme Court's review is a matter of right. The court must take that appeal and decide it in one way or another, and there are a variety of ways in which the court could decide it. As to the other category of cases, the Supreme Court's review is discretionary, and those are described on the right-hand side. And basically what that means is the court first looks at the initial material filed with it in that class of cases and decides whether it raises issues that the court should take up but is not compelled to take up. And so the court could decide at that point not to accept review, and the trial court's order would stand. If it accepted review, then the review would be much like it takes place for the other class of cases. So now to the specific sections, and it might be useful, even as you look at the bill, also to look at the section-by-section index that I've provided to you.
Mr. Shepard, if I could just break in, it might be helpful for the committee to just have a little more amplification on that distinction, because it's a pretty key point that separating those criminal matters where there's a matter of right appeal to the Supreme Court as opposed to those where it's discretionary. It's all felonies and Class A person misdemeanors. Could you just give me some examples of Class A person misdemeanors?
Mr. Chair, I can. That phrase is drawn from Oregon Administrative Rule 213.003-0001, which is a part of the Oregon Sentencing Guidelines. It's one of the principles that's used in parts of the Oregon Sentencing Guidelines. It is a defined term for those purposes, and it includes a variety of offenses that, although misdemeanors, have been judged to be severe in some way to merit some kind of enhanced sentencing for purposes of sentencing guidelines, for example. So, for example, resisting arrest, although a misdemeanor, nonetheless is defined to be a Class A person misdemeanor. Likewise, harassment involving offensive sexual contact is defined to be a Class A personal misdemeanor. So what we've done for purposes of our bill is to make this distinction along the same lines as the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has drawn in its rules. And the principle that we have tried, the reason we did that was to try and recognize that first of all, it represents both a judgment as to the appropriate disposition of the Supreme Court's resources and a prognostication as to the kinds of cases in which significant victim rights claims might arise. And so as to the disposition of the court's resources, we didn't want to burden the court with unnecessarily, or rather we wanted to give the court an opportunity to unburden itself of claims by victims that don't raise any new issues of law, perhaps issues that had already been decided by the court, in cases where the victim presumptively had perhaps not as much at stake in the particular case. And so that's what we tried to do here, was to define a class in which of cases on the assumption that victims would be more likely to raise very significant victims' rights claims in felony cases or Class A person misdemeanors, and that those are the kinds of cases that we would want the Supreme Court in any event to be taking up, as opposed to cases in which the victim might be less likely to have significant issues at stake or as significant issues at stake. And still, we also wanted to recognize that even in a misdemeanor case, even in a run-of-the-mill shoplifting case, there might be some very significant issue of victims' rights that the Supreme Court would want to take up so as to establish a principle of law or to answer a question that was vexing courts across the state. And so we settled on this discretionary class and mandatory class for that reason.
In that example you just gave, the shoplifting case, I assume that's one that would not be a person misdemeanor.
That's correct.
So it's a discretionary zone for the court.
That's correct.
There are no further questions, then proceed.
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shepherd, I have a question that requires perhaps a little bit of backing up to the beginning of when the claim is filed, and I'm trying to figure out how, on the flow chart it says the victim informs the court within 7 days of the alleged violation. I'm just trying to put that into some sort of real context of what is the alleged violation, because when I look at the bill, there's some new or should have known standard, and 7 days, if it's of the alleged I can imagine situations where victims within the first 7 days after being a victim of a crime aren't thinking about filing a claim form. So can you help me understand how that process gets started, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes. Let me give you an example. Suppose that in an adult court criminal prosecution, a victim is informed by the prosecutor that the victim has no right to be present at a motion filed by the defendant to exclude the victim's testimony for some reason in that case. You'll recall that under the Constitution, the victim has a right to be present at critical stages of the proceedings, and we've defined critical stages of the proceedings for purposes of the bill, hoping to fill that gap that otherwise would be left unanswered by any statutory answer. We've defined that to include motions that would be of that character. And so the victim would have a strong argument that the prosecutor's proposal to deny the victim the right to be present at that hearing is a breach that can be remedied under the bill. And so what the victim would do in the structure of the bill would obtain from the court the form that the Supreme Court will have promulgated by then that outlines the framework for filing all such claims. The victim would fill in the blanks or if the victim was represented by counsel, have assistance of counsel and do that. And then that claim would be initiated by filing that, or in the language of the flowchart, the court would be informed of that claim by filing that form with the court. And indeed, there are time limits that attach to, that would bar the victim's filing. If the victim learned of the pendency of the hearing, and then failed to do anything about it within 7 days of having learned of that, then there is a provision in the bill that would bar the victim at that stage from bringing forward the claim.
Thank you.
Let me turn to Section 2 of the bill. This is the section of the bill that contains definitions, and very significantly, it contains the definition I just discussed with Representative Bonamici for critical stages of the proceeding, but it also very significantly contains the definition for criminal proceeding, and I've outlined the significance of that in the notes column on the sheet that I have, but I want to drive it home here. The under the definition of criminal proceeding, which is the scope of this bill, that's, criminal proceedings are the things in which this bill applies for the most part. Those are actions at law conducted in the trial or juvenile court before or after sentencing or disposition. And that's significant because that means that certain kinds of proceedings in which the constitutional rights of victims may attach are not covered by the bulk of the statutory mechanism in the bill. For example, proceeding in the Board of Parole to revoke the parole of a parolee is not covered by the intricate statutory mechanism that we've laid out here. But we have provided in the bill and answered an important uncertainty in existing law that individuals who are victims who are seeking to assert constitutional rights in that kind of forum can do so through mandamus. And we provided that expressly in Section 19 of the bill. So those victims who have claims that arise outside of a criminal proceeding as it's defined here are not left remedyless by this bill. They are instead left to the standard approach of mandamus relief. So that's an important definition in that it defines and limits the application of the most of the mechanism of the bill to trial and juvenile court proceedings. Section 3 of the bill has a little bit of a catch-all, but there are some important provisions. First of all, it forbids the imposition of any fee for on the victim for filing a claim for relief. It also provides that if a defendant is represented by counsel, then the steps that require service of notice of various things under the mechanism of the bill can be filed on defendant's counsel so that you don't have to ferret out the whereabouts of the defendant if you're the victim seeking to make sure that the orders are served, or if you're the court with an obligation to deliver copies of materials, you can deliver those to counsel. And for lawyers, there's the all-important how do you count time on the calendar provision in subsection 3, sub 4, and we do, as you probably know, have a statute on that subject, and this bill incorporates that. Section 4 is intended to help avoid the necessity of invoking the process that's described in the bill. And it does this by requiring the prosecuting attorney and the trial court to engage in an interactive process that begins with the prosecutor, in most cases, filing a certification with the court in which the prosecutor says, yes, someone has accomplished the fulfillment of the victim's rights by notifying them of their rights, and in a very particular way requires the prosecutor to identify for the court the fact that the victim has been informed of various of their rights so that the victim can in a meaningful way effectuate those rights as provided later in the bill. The idea of that is to get the prosecutor and to encourage the prosecutor to engage in that process so the prosecutor can certify to the court and ultimately so that the victim will know what their rights are. without the necessity of enforcing them through this mechanism of this bill. If the prosecutor doesn't have sufficient information to make that certification, then the court has an obligation under the bill to make inquiries, including inquiries of the victim directly if the victim is present in the courtroom. That's what Section 4, in a nutshell, is about. We spent a lot of time adjusting the relative responsibilities of the prosecutor and the court in that process, and I'm feeling fairly confident that we've reached an arrangement there that's a workable, day-to-day workable process for the many thousands of cases that come through our courts and that prosecutors and courts are responsible for. Section 5 of the bill pertains specially to plea hearings or sentencing hearings. Plea hearings being circumstances where a defendant in adult court is changing a plea from not guilty to either no contest or guilty, or in juvenile court agreeing to a disposition of a case. And likewise, sentencing hearings have both an adult and a juvenile court corresponding provision. And what the bill provides is that it incorporates into its provisions an existing statute, ORS 135-406, which provides that in effect, the existing statute already reinforces the requirement of the Constitution that there be consultation on violent felony matters. And so, because the bill incorporates ORS 135-406, later in the bill we repeal that statute. So don't be alarmed if, as you review the bill, you see that we're repealing a statute that requires consultation between the prosecutor and the victim. We only do that because we incorporate those provisions into the text of this bill. So there's one place for folks to look as to the procedure for consultation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. And so would 2A be one of those points where the language or the intent of ORS 135-406 is included in verbiage?
Yes.
And later on, so that we aren't taken by surprise, thank you for putting that out, that you're repealing that particular statute.
Correct.
Thank you.
Let me just mention here that the working group yesterday identified the desirability of making a little bit of an adjustment to this provision, and when you see the Dash 1 amendments, I'm anticipating there may be an adjustment to this provision, and that is, as the bill is presently written, if the court determines at a sentencing hearing or at a plea hearing that the consultation hasn't yet taken place, there's absolutely no leeway for the court to proceed with the sentencing hearing. The working group discussed yesterday some fairly limited scenarios in which the interests of justice might make a very compelling reason for going forward with that. So, and we'll be prepared to address that adjustment when we come back before you to discuss what probably will be the Dash 1 amendments, but there may be some adjustment to that provision. Both the courts and the prosecutors involved in reviewing the matter suggested that there might be need for that, and I think we arrived at a consensus solution for that problem. Section 6 is the very section that Representative Bonamici referred to earlier as to the initiation of the victim's claim. And straightforwardly, I've already described, the Supreme Court will articulate a uniform form that will be applicable all throughout the state that victims will be able to turn to initiate a written claim. And if the claim happens to arise in open court when the victim is there, then the victim can make the claim orally without necessity, although the court can ask the victim nonetheless to fill out the claim so that the court has a very clear articulation of the nature of the claim. Here, too, we may have an adjustment in the Dash 1 amendments. I just want to flag it for you so that when we come back before you, you may want to hear from us further about it. As we presently have Section 6 drafted, what happens when the victim files the claim is that the court is obligated to issue a show cause order of the character I described earlier. There's no alternative to the court. The court must issue it. And that's true under the draft, even if the court were to look at the victim's claim and say, even if everything in the victim's claim is absolutely gospel truth, and all of the allegations in the claim are exactly as described, still, they're not claiming about, they haven't asserted a claim that I can recognize under the Constitution, under Article 1, Section 42 or 43. It's just facially invalid because the victim didn't understand the process, is trying to get, for example, just any kind of claim that would fall out facially outside the process. And yet under the draft, the court would still have to issue the show cause order and cause all of that machinery to turn. So in the Dash 1 amendments, I'm anticipating that you will see some kind of procedure for the court to make an early determination of facial invalidity of the claim, which still would be appealable by the victim in the usual way. So if the court made an error, the victim could appeal that determination. So look for that in the Dash 1 amendments. Turning to Section 7. Section 7 is a section that recognizes the requirement of the United States Constitution that it's not possible to have a legally binding effect on anyone who didn't have notice of and an opportunity to contest a claim that is asserted in effect against them that would affect their rights. And it is possible that victims might seek and in fact obtain from courts orders that would affect persons other than the defendant, the prosecutor, or the victim. Although we think this is not likely to be the largest number of cases, there may be cases in which the victim seeks and obtains such an order. For example, an order directed to an investigator employed by the defendant who is insisting on attempting to do an interview with the victim, breaching one of the rights that I recall that I described to you earlier. It's possible that the victim would seek an order from the court under this mechanism, ordering that investigator to stop trying to contact the victim. And so that investigator ordinarily wouldn't be in court and ordinarily wouldn't have notice and an opportunity to be heard as to that order, and yet the order has potentially legally binding effect. And so what we provided in this section in order to comply with those due process requirements is that if in my hypothetical, the victim wishes to bind somebody who's not already a participant in the proceeding, it's up to the victim to make sure that that person receives the show cause order so that that person can appear in court and object to the order if that's what they wish and then to contest it in the hearing. And the bill further provides that if you don't do that, then the order doesn't have any binding effect as to the person that you'd later want to enforce it against. So that's why that Section 7 is in the bill. Section 8 governs the circumstance in which a show cause order is issued and served on all the appropriate folks and nobody objects, the default order in that case. And what we've provided there is that the court will make findings based on what the victim has already submitted to the court, and then assess whether the victim's proposed remedy or another remedy that the court perceives is allowed by the Constitution, is allowed by the Constitution, and then enter an order accordingly granting that. Or alternatively, if the court were to determine that the Constitution bars the remedy the victim seeks, so for example, a victim alleges a failure to timely notice of the right to be present at a critical stage of the proceeding, but then goes on to say, I want $100 from the defendant because I didn't get adequate notice, and the remedy I want is $100 because I missed a day of work or an hour of work or whatever kind of circumstance. Well, as you remember, the Constitution bars that kind of relief. And so in that case, the court couldn't simply issue an order, even if it were a default, requiring the defendant to pay $100. The court would have to look and would have authority under the bill to look at the circumstances alleged by the victim and try and craft a remedy that would be constitutional and permitted for the victim. Section 9 of the bill is intended to squeeze out of the system as many eve of trial or day of trial problems as that relate to the rights of victims as they might be exercised in trial, intended to squeeze out of the system, or at least to give as much advance notice of the existence of those disputes as we possibly can. And the idea here is to try and raise those at least 14 days, to compel everybody to raise those at least 14 days before the trial to which the right would be asserted comes about. And we're referring in the working group to these as sort of anticipatory motions. These are cases in which the victim says, you know, I really want to make sure that I have the right to be that I am able to be there at trial, and the prosecutor's saying things to me that make me suggest that I'm not entitled to, or I've heard that the defendant is going to try and exclude me from trial. Or it may be a defense motion that says, I don't want to have the victim present at trial. And we want to have those issues raised well in advance of the trial so that the courts can anticipate and deal with them appropriately. Section 10 of the bill describes what the trial court does or has authority to do in order to deal with the ongoing flow of work in the trial court pending the resolution of a claim that's scheduled for a hearing. So in this circumstance, a victim has filed a claim, the court issued the show cause order, someone objected, and it's been set down for a hearing for the trial court. And pending that hearing, what we provided here in Section 10 is that the court may reschedule other things that are necessary in order to allow that hearing to go forward and to effectuate the victim's rights. So, for example, if the right at issue were the right to appear at that hearing to exclude the victim's evidence, this Section 10 would allow the court, give the court clear authority, to postpone that hearing on the admissibility of the victim's evidence, pending the resolution of the victim's right to be there at that hearing, so that you wouldn't moot out the victim's claim by simply going forward with the hearing and thus make the victim's claim useless at that point. And we provided in this section of the bill criteria for the trial court to consider in determining whether to reschedule or to postpone proceedings in the trial court. We have, importantly in this provision, we've provided an ultimate cap on how long those postponements can be, and that cap is 14 days as provided on lines 16 and 17 of page 6. And this is in part to recognize that we want this to be a very efficient process, not only for the victim's sake, but also because we do not want to create circumstances where we run afoul of the defendant's speedy trial rights. And so in this provision, as well as many others in the bill, we provided very accelerated provisions and limitations on the length of time that postponements or suspensions of proceedings can be ordered. The Section 11 of the bill governs the actual hearing on the victim's claim. And so, as you might expect, we've offered a rule of evidence. We've said that the relevant evidence is admissible by the trial court, so we're leaving to the trial court's discretion, for the most part, judgments about what kind of evidence will be admitted. We provide elsewhere in the bill that the Oregon rules of evidence do not generally apply in these proceedings. So what that means is that hearsay evidence would be admissible in these proceedings at the discretion of the trial court, much as they are in many other kinds of pretrial matters. But we have, nonetheless, in another part of the bill, preserved and protected privileges. So it won't be possible for privileges to be breached in the Section 11 hearings. And we have provided a standard of proof, which is preponderance of the evidence, which is the usual standard in civil proceedings. We've required in this section that the court enter findings and enter a written order unless the order is issued in open court, and to enter a written order that describes the reasons for its conclusions. And all that is designed to ensure that the appellate court has an adequate record to review, as well as, of course, to inform the folks that as the reasoning of the court. Section 12 provides some of the limitations on a victim's claims, or indeed on other person's claims. And here, for example, the requirement is that if you don't file a response to the show cause order, then you're barred from asserting a claim. We've also tried in this section to deal with the problem of multiple victim cases. And here, the problem is you may have victims with differing interests or parallel interests in a given case, more than one victim in a given matter. And we didn't want to create a system in which the trial court would have to deal first with the first victim's complaint, then separately with the second victim's complaint, then separately with the third victim's complaint, particularly where all of those complaints may be related and there was no good reason not to bring them all at once. And so we've embedded in this section, Section 12, some limitations that we hope will forestall that kind of seriatim repetition of the same or related claims. Section 13 of the bill is the first of the appellate sections, here we provide that this is the exclusive appellate process for reviewing orders issued in the way that I've described. And as I previously mentioned to you in connection with the flowchart, these are appeals directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. It's in this section that we distinguish between the classes of cases that the chair and I discussed in our discussion earlier. Section 14 is the section that applies to appeals in felony and Class A person misdemeanors. Here again, this is the category of appeals in which appeal is a matter of right. And this is actually the longest section in the bill, and I'm going to spend the least time on it simply to tell you that that we've embedded throughout very, really, I would say, extraordinarily tight deadlines on the Supreme Court for each of each stage of and on the participants in the appeal. Indeed, I think it's correct to say that an appeal pursuant to this provision would be the fastest appeal, barring extraordinary things, as a recent case that you all probably are familiar with. Barring extraordinary cases of that kind, this is the fastest appellate mechanism that would exist in Oregon law.
I'd like to just ask first, how full was the input that you got from the judicial department and particularly people with a Supreme Court kind of perspective and what their docket looks like?
Mr. Chair, I think we've had fairly full input. You can see from the roster that the judicial department had a number of participants, including two distinguished trial judges from Multnomah County, one from Multnomah County and one from Coos County. Who aided in our evaluation of the trial court features of this, and then Mr. Nass, the Supreme Court counsel, has participated actively in the work group and indeed assisted, and I would say, I think without embarrassing him, drafted most of this section of the proposal. The Solicitor General Mary Williams also has been involved in our office reviewing this element in detail. We've had some very very high level appellate practitioners looking at this, and it's not my particular area of expertise, but it has been fly-specked by folks whose area of expertise it is.
Just to follow up on that, it would seem as though we've spread. Spread a fairly broad net in extending it to victims of the appeal as a matter of right to all felonies and Class A person misdemeanors. And So the people are comfortable, I take it, that that is not going to overload what is otherwise a highly pressured situation sometimes for the court.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm hopeful that as your committee's deliberations proceed on this bill, you'll hear from others who are better equipped than I am to give you some kind of an estimate of how kinds of caseload, volume of cases. And I think partly your question turns on that kind of prognostication. And all I can tell you in answer to your direct answer to your question is that the members of the working group at least seem, I think it's fair to say, seem to think that we've created a manageable procedure for the court. I don't know, Hardy, do you have a...
Only to add, Mr. Chair, that I think that when the Judicial Department appears before the committee, at least with the adoption of some limited Dash 1 amendments that apply to these provisions, my understanding, the Judicial Department's position would be that those provisions of the bill are agreeable to the Judicial Department, are supported by the Judicial Department, or at least not opposed by the Judicial Department.
Yep. Representative Krieger.
One of the conversations that Chief Justice had talked to us about earlier, he was discussing the clearing up of the backlog that has taken place since he's been there. So there isn't this big backlog that they're working on. I think he wants to continue to be as caught up as he can so this type of thing won't cause trouble.
Chair McPherson and members, as I mentioned, I believe, earlier, the provision in this measure of direct review by the Supreme Court of Oregon, which is unusual, does exist in some processes in Oregon law, was itself a proposal from the Judicial Department.
Thank you.
Moving to Section 15, which is the corresponding provision for appeals in the other class of cases. This is the discretionary class. And the basic principle here is that it incorporates all of the procedures for the mandatory review process, except for a few exceptions that are unique to the discretionary procedure. So it's basically the same process with the exceptions that are noted in Section 15. And so in order to understand what process applies in the discretionary review category, one needs to look both at Section 14 and at Section 15. But I won't repeat it because it's the same kind of process. In Section 16, we provide for the appellate court corresponding provision. We have the provision that corresponds to the trial court rescheduling. You recall that when the order to show cause is issued, the trial court has authority to reschedule matters that are related to the victim's claim. Here what we provided is that when the appeal takes place, that the trial court shall stay for a period of 21 days all matters that directly impact or are directly impacted by the order on appeal. Now, the basic rule for taking an appeal from a trial court proceeding is that once the matter is in the hands of the appellate court, the trial court, as a general rule, loses authority to do much of anything with that case. They lose jurisdiction over virtually any aspect of that case, in some cases all aspects of the case. We provided a different rule here. What we've said here is that when there is an appeal from one of these kinds of claims from a trial court, that what is stayed are only those parts of the trial court proceeding that are relevant to the issue on appeal. And the reason we did that is that we didn't want to gum up the works of the ongoing criminal prosecution unnecessarily by holding it up while the Supreme Court was considering this appeal. So it's only the parts of the trial court proceeding that you need to suspend or stay in order to allow the Supreme Court to decide the case effectively that are stayed pursuant to the stay. So, for example, if the victim's claim is that the trial court didn't adequately protect me in its pretrial release order, and that's the issue that's up on appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, the trial court can go forward with a hearing on a motion to suppress and consideration of the defendant's challenge to the indictment and so forth, so that we don't necessarily jam up the machinery in the trial court. So on to Section 17, and we're very near the end.
Could I just interject, Mr. Chair? I think it's worth noting that in Section 16, that in the in Section 16, the Supreme Court is vested with authority to extend or reduce the length of stay, that automatic stay, or to vacate it on its own motion, the motion of a victim, prosecuting attorney, defendant, or other person against whom relief was ordered. And then the measure sets forth various factors the Supreme Court, in addition to any others, should consider in determining whether to take one of those forms of action. And again, here also is included a specific reference in lines 41 to 3 on page 10 of the among the factors to be considered are the rights guaranteed to the victim, the prosecuting attorney, the defendant, or any other person against whom it was under the Constitution of Oregon or the United States or Oregon statute of law. So an automatic stay, in other words, can be modified by the Supreme Court.
Section 17, you recall when I talked about the definition of criminal proceeding, I told you that it applies in the trial court. Those are proceedings that are taking place in the trial court. I also noted that there's a good argument, strong argument to be made that elements of victims' rights may attach in the appellate courts as well. And so, for example, the right to a transcript of the appellate court proceeding may be a right that a victim can assert. And because we've defined criminal proceeding in the way we have, we haven't needed to build an enforcement mechanism that would play out in the appellate court. But nonetheless, those are real rights that victims have. It may be real rights that the victims can assert under the Constitution. And so what we decided to do was to place the burden on the Attorney General to make sure that victims' rights in the appellate process are recognized. And that seems logical to do so because the Attorney General represents the state in all criminal appeals. And so we're going to be involved in virtually all, probably all, cases in which victims are involved in the appellate court process. And so when we make appearances in a regular criminal case, State versus Pete Shepard, when on the occasion of our first appearance with the appellate court, we would have to file under Section 17 a certification that says our office has done all that we can do to ensure that whatever rights attach in the appellate process have been respected by the system and by us as to the victim of that offense. Section 18. Provides really kind of insurance to make it clear that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court does in fact have rule and order making authority to create the various and to fulfill the various requirements that we've imposed in the course of the bill, drafting the forms for victims to use, for example. And so Section 18 provides that statutory foundation. And then finally, Section 19, this is the section that ensures that a remedy is available for victims even though they may be seeking effectuation of their rights in other than a criminal proceeding. And the line that does that is lines 23 to 25 on page 11. A remedy for violations of sections 42 and 43, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, in any other proceeding, that is, a proceeding other than a criminal proceeding, may be enforced by writ of mandamus under these existing statutes, so that we provide it expressly, as the Constitution permits, for a remedy in each of those other contexts. Let me just turn to one aspect of the remainder of the bill and note it for you, and then I'll be mercifully done for you. Skipping over the bulk of the bill, which, as as I mentioned, is mainly necessary to accommodate the possibility of passage of one but not the other resolution and any combination of those. I want to turn your attention to pages 59 to page 59. I'm sorry, section 59, which would be page 31 of the bill. And this is an amendment. This section of the bill, this and section 60, amend elements of the juvenile code that arguably will be inconsistent with the Constitution if the people approve HJR 49 and 50 or both, or either of them. And in particular, for example, on page 32 of the bill, in section 60, lines 39 to 40, existing law provides that the failure to notify the victim of a hearing under this subsection, and this is one of the hearings in the context of a juvenile proceeding, or the failure of the victim to appear at the hearing does not affect the validity of the proceeding. Well, if the people amend the Constitution, in fact, it is possible that a victim could obtain an order from a court saying, no, you conducted a hearing that violated my right to be present at that hearing. You have to do it over. In effect, that would affect the validity of the hearing. And so what we have provided is simply to strike that part of the bill and not to do so for the purpose of suggesting that gives rise to some new claim outside of the newly created enforcement mechanism, but simply to say that that provision would be inconsistent or potentially inconsistent as applied with the newly amended Constitution. So let me give you an example to be real clear about the legislative history of this provision. Let's suppose that a juvenile who had agreed to a disposition of a petition alleging that the juvenile had committed an act that would have been a crime if the juvenile had been an adult. Let's suppose the juvenile who had admitted to that and agreed to that disposition subsequently had second thoughts and fortuitously discovered that the victim, in violation of the victim's rights to be present at that disposition hearing or that disposition proceeding, hadn't been notified of that proceeding. In striking lines 39 to 40 on page 32, we do not intend to suggest that that juvenile, that youth, could obtain relief from the court from the deal that he had struck in that court. We're not intending to suggest that he could undo the validity of the proceeding by which he admitted to the disposition. And I make that point, trying to make it as precisely as I can, because it's very difficult when one strikes from a statute a provision that is in tension with with the Constitution. It's very difficult to avoid creating a basis for somebody wrongly to infer that you're intending to create a new right that gives rise to. And so I'm trying to rebut any such inference from having that embedded in the history of this provision. And with that, Mr. Chair, I rest.
Well, it was an impressive presentation, Mr. Shepherd. I want to go back to one of the points that you made midstream, and I've been searching around a bit for the section about parties who are other than the prosecutor, the who the orders could be. And I think you used an example of somebody who wanted to interview a victim.
Yes. Mr. Chair, it probably would be Section 7, I suspect, is probably what drew your attention. And the example that I used is that under the Constitution, Article 1, Section 42, gives victims the rights, the right to refuse the defendant's interview. And it is conceivable that that a victim, that the effort, the defendant's effort to interview a victim might be executed through a defense investigator. When we talked about these issues in the work group, frankly, it's a little difficult to come up with very clear examples in which the victim would have to bring in someone other than the defendant or the prosecutor into the proceeding in order to effectuate the victim's rights. Because even in my example, arguably the victim could seek an order ordering the defendant to order the defendant's investigator not to do something. And so there would be, even in my example, there would be ways perhaps of effectuating the victim's rights without bringing in someone outside the circle of the prosecutor, the defendant.
Or I think I misunderstood the comment before, because I thought it was something that could affect the ability of just unrelated press individuals to interview victims, which I didn't see here to happen.
No, indeed, Mr. Chair. The constitutional right does not extend that far. It extends to the right to refuse an interview. I forget the exact language, attributable to the defendant or worse than effect.
Okay. Representative Barker.
Thank you. Along those lines, I made a note when we were talking about that, and you said you'd have to notify the investigator. Would it not work to notify the defense attorney? The case I'm thinking of, or cases, is where an investigator will approach the victim and say, I'm from the DA's office. And they're to stay, of course, meaning defense attorney, but they know they're fooling the victim, thinking they're talking to the district attorney's office. So in order to prevent that, if I'm the prosecutor, I might tell my victim, file a notice to the lawyer, you don't want to be contacted by their investigators. Would that work? You wouldn't have to actually locate the investigator?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, yes, I think that the, and let me give you a little variant on, it wouldn't be necessary for the, under the bill, for the prosecutor to seek to have the victim file the claim under those circumstances. Under the bill and under the Constitution, the victim is authorized the prosecutor to assert the victim's claim. So you wouldn't have, in your hypothetical, you wouldn't necessarily have to have the victim initiate the process. You'd have to have authority from the victim to assert their right. But then, as specifically to your question, it would depend on the kind of relief that you wanted. If you wanted an order that said to the investigator, Pete Shepard, don't bug me, then if you wanted to be able to enforce that order, you would have to serve Pete Shepard with the order to show cause. If you were satisfied with an order that said to the defense counsel and to the defendant, said to the defendant, for example, you are ordered to direct your investigator to refrain from bugging Pete Shepard. If you were satisfied with that, then the only person you'd need to notify would be the defendant. Because then if the investigator contacted me, your remedy would be to seek sanctions from the court as to the defendant. You couldn't seek sanctions directly as to the investigator, but you could seek them as to the defendant.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Attorney General Myers and Mr. Shepard, for all your work on this. I really commend you. It's a significant amount of work. I have a question about the difference between the review as a matter of right and the discretionary review. The way I understand it is the matter of right versus the discretionary review depends on, I guess you'd say, the seriousness of the crime. And I wonder if there was any discussion about instead having review based on the seriousness of the violation to the victim. And, for example, I can think of, I'll give you an example and then you can tell me what's wrong with it, I guess. If, say for example, there's one of these felonies or class A person misdemeanors, but the alleged violation to the victim is you didn't give me a transcript of the appellate court proceeding. Then you have a victim in an other criminal proceeding who says, you're not allowing me to be in the criminal proceeding. It seems to me that that would be a more important issue to get a review by a matter of right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, indeed we did have that discussion in the work group, and as your question and the Chair's earlier question suggests, there are many different principles one could try and establish to, once you decide to have one class of discretionary and one class of mandatory review cases, and And your principle, the severity of the violation of the victim's rights, and if you will, or the significance of the victim's right at issue, is a theoretical principle that one could try and articulate to distinguish between the two classes. The problem was, as I recall the discussion, that it became very difficult to define, first of all, how you would classify which right was most significant in terms of relative significance as to, first of all, classes of claims by victims, and then secondarily, it may be that to a particular victim, because of the particular vulnerabilities of the victim, a particular claim of violation may be very significant to that individual victim, but as a class, not represent severe, what one might characterize as severe violation of rights. The example of a victim who receives repeated telephone calls from a defense investigator, unwanted telephone calls from a defense investigator, for example, some victims might well shrug that off, but some may be particularly vulnerable to that, and to those victims, they might judge that to be tremendously significant. And so we foundered on the effort of trying to distinguish between them, and we settled for the relatively mechanical measurement that we've got here with all of its faults. The faults of all mechanical measurements is that it doesn't fully, it's only a representation of the best classification.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Okay.
I don't doubt that what you have is more workable, so I'm glad you had the discussion. Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might be asking some fairly elementary questions since I wasn't on the Judiciary Committee during the session, but my first one, and then if you'll allow me a second, I'd appreciate it. Is there a time constraint on when someone could come forward to claim that they are a victim in the case? Do they have to do it at the beginning, or could they not come in any time during the
they process? Must, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, they must do it within 7 days of the date that they knew or should have known of the violation about which they're complaining.
Great, thank you. I appreciate that. Follow-up?
You may.
It seems in the notification, the burden, and correct me if I'm wrong, is mostly on the district attorney or the deputy district attorney to make sure that the victim has been notified of court proceedings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, yes, although I think the burden actually is more... There are many players in the system who have those obligations, and the compliance process that the Attorney General addressed as to Section 1, in fact, addresses pieces of that, because the notification requirement actually extends even to the point of the first law enforcement contact, for example.
Okay. And then could I ask one more, Mr. Chair?
Yes, you may.
So are there any constraints on what the remedy might be if, for example, a deputy district attorney just through workload or some other human error didn't notify the victim, the person was given maybe a lighter sentence than the victim would have liked, they get injured again by the perpetrator? Is there, I assume that there would be constraints on what kind of claim they could file against the deputy district attorney. Could you just explain that to me a little?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, in the particular case, the victim would have no claim because jeopardy would have attached to the in the prosecution of the criminal defendant at sentencing, and as a result of that, if there was a violation of the victim's rights in that proceeding, there would be nothing the victim could do about it. So there, in your particular hypothetical, there wouldn't be any remedy the victim could pursue at all. And the reason for that is that even as amended in HGR 49 and 50, those amendments do not change the constitutional protection that a defendant has against being placed in jeopardy more than once for the same offense, for example. So in your particular case, but taking your question that going beyond the particular case, there are limits in the nature of the remedy that might be ordered. So, for example, the Constitution and nothing in the bill would authorize the award of damages against the deputy DA who had failed to comply with the victim's rights in your example. So there are limits.
Mr. Shepard, I want to follow up on your response to Representative Shields' first question about identification of a person as a victim. The bill has a seven-day period within which the victim who alleges a violation has to say there's been a violation.
Yes.
But the definition of victim just incorporates the constitutional standard, which is that a person determined by the prosecuting attorney to have suffered direct financial, psychological, or physical harm. Is there any mechanism described here or elsewhere in law that establishes a time frame or a process for defining who the victim is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. First of all, as to the bill, we have tried to anticipate that. And we've done that in the certification process that I described to you. This is when the district attorney is coming before the trial court and filing the certification with the court. And that certification includes certification as to the names of the victims known to the prosecuting attorney. And the reason that's important is that the constitutional definition to which you referred might include individuals who are not identified by name in the indictment or in the charging instrument that's before the court. The classic example would be that the family members of the victim in a murder case are not identified in the indictment. The indictment identifies only the decedent, the individual who's been murdered, as the victim. And so simply from inspection of that document, one wouldn't recognize that the spouse, for example, of the decedent is in fact a victim entitled to bring claims under the Constitution and under the bill. So the first thing we did was to try and provide in the bill this in the certification process a mechanism whereby the prosecutor would be on duty, in effect, to identify for the court everybody that the prosecutor views to be a victim. And that's significant because it would itself be a basis for a claim. If a person believed that they were a victim, but the prosecutor had failed to identify them as such, and upon discovery of that person who had not been identified by the prosecutor as a victim, but who claimed that status under the Constitution, if they did it within 7 days of discovering their omission, then they would be entitled to bring a claim in the manner we've described in the bill. So that itself would be a claim cognizable under the process we've described.
Any further questions? Well, then, seeing none, gentlemen, thank you very much. A very informative presentation. Your time and energy and hard work on this proposal. That concludes the time that's allotted for our committee meetings. We will be resuming public hearing on this bill tomorrow. So I'm going to close for today the public hearing on House Bill 3633, and we'll resume and take up Mr. Armstrong, who had signed up, but we don't have time to hear from him today, but we'll have to hear from him tomorrow. Close the public hearing, and that concludes the work of the House Judiciary Committee for Tuesday, the 5th of February, 2008. We are adjourned.